Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, Mark, we've had a busy week, haven't we? We went on a date last Saturday evening, didn't we? Went to a gig. And it was a gig with a difference, wasn't it, really? It was unlike...
It was fabulously un-rock and roll.
It was fabulously un-rock and roll.
In that it started at, I think, at 7 o'clock in the evening, and it was advertised to last for 75 minutes. It lasted for 75 minutes precisely, and then there was an encore, and it was in a little venue, part of Zedel Brasserie in Piccadilly Circus. It's just very un-rock and roll, isn't it? A little venue called the Crazy Cox, and it was the son of Ben Sidran, the great Leo Sidran.
It was fantastic.
With his little French band playing his wonderful kind of, how do you describe it? It's kind of jazz and funk, isn't it? And, you know, just beautiful songs.
It was beautiful. It was such a civilized experience, the whole thing. I booked the tickets a while back. And then when it came to the day of the gig, they sent you an email just reminding you what time it started, which I thought was a very, very nice touch, actually.
Yeah.
When we got there, I was preparing to display the tickets and so forth. They said, no, just give me your name, you know. So they checked your name off a list and then conducted you to your table and your two chairs there. And then a person called a waitress, Mark, a waitress, you probably never come across this before, actually came over.
Not at a gig.
And said, would you like a drink? And we ordered a couple of drinks and whatever. And then, amazingly, Leo Sidran came over and said hello to us.
He recognized our picture from the podcast.
Yes.
We've been talking about his dad's records and how many there were and how they were all still freely available to listen to. And he'd heard about it and started listening to the podcast, which is great, wasn't it?
I thought that was a lovely touch, and in future, whenever I go to a gig, I shall expect the artist to actually make their way from wherever they are to come to my table, and henceforth it's going to be a table with a couple of drinks on it, and actually welcome me in person. You know, that's the minimum I shall expect.
Yeah,
in the
at
future.
Which point you can then say, well, thanks very much, carry on. Good luck. You can take to the stage.
You may begin.
Linda Thompson was there.
We bumped into Linda Thompson, didn't we?
We'd actually only been talking about her.
We had.
Shoot out the lights, I think, earlier on the podcast we recorded that day. And there she was with a pal going to see Leo Sidran. Very good.
And she's got a show coming up at the, what's it called? Cadogan Hall in Chelsea in the summer. Of other performers doing her songs, which goes under the name of Proxy Music.
Proxy
Get it?
Music.
Proxy Music. Very good. So talking of Proxy Music and Roxy Music, the second feature of the week was we had a Word in Your Ear with Phil Manzanera at 21 Soho. That's our first live event of this year. And Phil Manzanera talking about his autobiography and also playing a couple of tunes. It was rather special, wasn't it?
No, it was fantastic. Fantastic. What a good story. What a good talker. And a key moment in that, I think, which we should mention, is that he made more money when he recorded, didn't he, a guitar figure, a guitar riff, while sitting on a sofa, or wrote it anyway, while sitting on a sofa in 1978, lasts about 6 seconds, and that he had made more money from that one piece of recording than he had made in the entire time he'd been in Roxy Music. Wasn't that absolutely amazing?
All thanks to the fact that Kanye had ended up on a Kanye West record.
He'd been rung up, hadn't he, by a representative from the record company saying that we're going to use this track, and he was very interested about it. And then he sort of said, he rang up the publishers and said, well, this sounds good, there must be some money in it. So we've been talking to them for ages, you'll be very pleased.
Absolutely.
And the end result was that he got a third, didn't he, of the compositional royalty for the track. And he said it was just like, I can't remember how he described it. I think he said it was like a fruit machine where you pull a lever and it just keeps, the money keeps on pouring out. Because it had then become, it got onto movie soundtracks, and it got onto to adverts. It was absolutely amazing. What was it called? No Church in the
No
Wild.
No Church in the Wild. That's, it was a huge hit.
Yeah.
Huge hit. But it's just goes to show that, you know, as he pointed out, that these things can happen to you if you stick around long enough,
yeah.
You know, if you're there to benefit from them when you're in your 70s or whatever, you know, it's money from home.
Because I didn't realise that, you know, there were people there preparing things that could possibly make samples.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And on this particular track, this guy had chosen 10 samples, one of which was this thing by Phil Manzanera. There's also Sunshine Help Me by Spooky Tooth. And there was a James Brown track, you know, and they just pick those things and say, is there anything you can do with that? And I thought that was amazing how random it all was, that process.
Yeah, and so that interview with Phil Manzanera is with you now, and he was very good, and his book is very good. It's really interesting, and because he's had a very varied career, you know, started off in, you know, obviously grew up pretty much in Cuba in South America, and then came to Britain when he was a teenager. Who else have we talked to this week? We talked to Charlene Spiteri.
That was interesting because that was the second former hairdresser we have talked to in just two or three weeks. Susie Ronson, of course, who was Bowie's stylist. She was really interesting about that. She said that being a hairdresser, she was a hairdresser when she was a teenager in a salon in Glasgow, said was the best possible kind of apprenticeship, didn't she, for being a pop star? Because it's a very theatrical thing.
Mm.
You're on, you're performing, you're entertaining, you're sort of on show. And she also chose all the music for the mixtapes that they played in the salon. And she was good value, I thought. Very funny.
She was really interesting. And I thought when she told us about John Cougar Mellencamp was particularly
yes.
interesting, that Texas had been on tour with John Mellencamp some while back, and in America, and obviously in the sports lot. And her expectation, based on her experience of the music business that far, was that that wouldn't necessarily mean she would ever meet him. You know what I mean? Because this is one of the great... We always tend to think that, you know, the backstage, they're all one big family, whatever it is, you know, and they're all sharing the same canteen and so forth and the same kind of running jokes. But no, they're not. The headliners, in most cases, simply do not meet the support slot. You know, I was reading about recently Lucinda Williams' book. She goes on tour with Bob Dylan and Van Morrison, doesn't she? She tours yeah. all over America and literally never meets either of them.
Never meets either. There's some group, and I can't remember now who they were, who did go on tour with Dylan and never met until the last night, when obviously his manager had frog-marched him into their dressing room. And he says, oh, thank you very much, and I'm so glad you came on our tour, and all the best, you know. And then about 20 minutes later, apparently, they ran into him again. And he said, well, thanks very much, so glad you came on our tour. So they felt that some of the shine had gone off that, too.
Actually. So anyway, in the case of Texas and John Mellencamp, he was anything but. He turned up on the dressing room door and welcomed them to the tour and so forth. And actually, he said, come and watch the show from the side of the stage. And halfway through his act, he kind of danced over to Charlene, who was in the wings, and said, do you know Pink Houses? And she thought, well, I don't really, but in for a penny, in for a pound. And I thought, so she went on stage and sang it with him, which I thought, showed amazing nerve, actually, to do that.
Incredible nerve, especially in front of all his most ardent supporters. You know,
absolutely.
We'd be wishing they were doing that themselves and know every syllable of the lyric.
Yeah. So she was terrifically good value. That, again, is out there or will be out there soon. And here's a good opportunity to point out that if you were a Patreon supporter, you would obviously be able to access all of this before anyone else and in an ad-free format. And you'd also have the warm glow that comes from knowing that you're doing work of national importance. So if you want to investigate that, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear. We'll be back in a moment.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
And we're back. Dave, is there a record that's had more consequences for more people than Layla, which was recorded 53 years ago? It's astonishing, isn't it? I was just reading this morning that the auction has happened. You know, Patty Boyd was putting all her various possessions and things up for sale, and the letters she got from Eric Clapton at the time. And the cover of Layla, the cover artwork itself for the Derek and the Dominoes album, has sold for, I think it's £1,960,000 or something. It's absolutely amazing, isn't it? And it's just such a fascinating story, because we talked before about the kind of the love affair, the love triangle, you know, which did overlap slightly. I think I got that slightly wrong, that actually Eric fell in love with Patty Boyd towards the end of the late 60s, didn't he, and told her, and she and George Harrison discovered and was kind of upset about it. But although George Harrison and Patty Boyd's relationship was obviously disintegrating massively at the time, so it wasn't until a bit later that they got together and got married, I think, at the end of the 70s. But anyway, there's a wonderful moment when he played her the original version of the song, which this completely threw her, and she just thought, "This clearly must be my destiny," you know. But the story of the song is extraordinary, isn't it? Starts off with him inspired by a 12th century Persian poet.
All kinds of things in this story just make me want to stop and scratch my head. The idea that kind of energetic heterosexual rock star, you know, in 1969-70 or whatever, he's actually reading 12th century Persian poetry. I find absolutely extraordinary. Yes. You know, I can imagine people talking about reading 12th century Persian poetry, but actually doing it, I do not know. And the thing that intrigues me about the correspondence with Patty Boyd that was sold as part of this auction in recent times, it's the idea that there was a time when people actually put pen to paper, wrote letters with really rather good handwriting.
But also, they're very considered, aren't they?
Because now,
if you're sending a text, you're sending an email, you're just hammering it out and bang, and if it's no good, I'll write another one to make the point that I'd forgotten I hadn't made, you know. But then when you wrote letters, you did sit and think about it first and compose what you were going to say.
It is amazing. One of the letters I looked at, actually, it contains the word ascertain.
Yeah.
Now, people don't use the word. Lawyers use the word ascertain. You know, people seeking to be precise use that word.
You don't imagine Eric Clapton using it.
You really don't. But anyway, so he works up this song, which is kind of downbeat, really. And is only changed when Duane Allman comes along to join Derek and the Dominoes. And it's at that point that it acquires the thing that makes it still memorable to this day, which is that it's a riff, isn't it? It's a lick, you know. It's brilliantly done. Loads of learned investigations into the actual derivation of that lick. Some people trace it to an Albert King track from the late 60s. Some people, Lucas Eyre showed me this week, trace it to the Everly Brothers version of Walking the Dog from their album Beat and Soul, I think it's called, from 1965. Where James Burton, in the second guitar break, you can go and listen to this on Spotify if you want to, the Emily Brothers version of Walking the Dog, that's where that riff sounds to me to actually start.
Precisely the same riff, isn't it? I mean, maybe it was one that a lot of people used to talk, because it's just a little warm-up in the third bar of a four-bar figure, isn't it, to lead up to the start of a new bar. But, I mean, maybe a lot of people used it, but that is precisely the riff.
It is.
And the interesting pop fact was, wasn't Jim Gordon playing
Jim Gordon actually played drums on that session. And the bit that's put on the end of Layla for no good reason, really, which is that kind of piano instrumental, which Jim Gordon, the late Jim Gordon, claims to have written, which apparently, according to Rita Coolidge and her autobiography, is something that she wrote with him when he was her partner. And that then turned up on that record. And according to Bobby Whitlock, who sang on that record, the only reason it was put on there was that Jim Gordon used to grouse about having no publishing share of Eric Clapton's records. So Eric just gave him that bit, said, all right, you can put that on the end of the record.
To keep the peace, didn't he? That was the whole thing.
Keep the peace. So years later, Jim Gordon, complex psychiatric history, you know, which we talked about in recent podcasts. There's an excellent book about it. And he was eventually incarcerated for killing his mother. There is nothing the story lacks. Nothing the story lacks. And so the royalties end up going to his daughter. Layla, at the time it first comes out, it's a flop, because nobody knows who Derek and the Dominoes are, because he's decided he's not going to be Eric any longer. You know, he's just going to hide behind this band name, with the result that the record utterly flops, but slowly becomes an enormous hit through FM radio and compilation albums and all kinds of things. You can't imagine how much money Layla must have made over the years, and how little of it really is owed to what Eric Clapton did, really. You know, it's what loads of other people...
Well, it's all the other people who transformed it. It was Duane Allman changing the pace of it and having that lick, wasn't it? It was, you know, the bit written by Rita Coolidge for which she never got any credit. So many factors.
And then the thing that makes it the biggest hit of all, many years later, decades later, Unplugged. Eric Clapton does Unplugged and is persuaded to do a kind of downbeat acoustic coffee shop version
of
Layla.
J.J. Cale version, isn't it? Yeah.
Which is the biggest hit of his entire career. And of course, doesn't have the piano bit at the end, but, you know, Jim Gordon will still have a benefit from it, you know, because that's the way the publishing works. And it just strikes me, you look at the whole story, you think how ridiculous it is that within the traditions of the music business, the writer gets the lion's share in what is actually a massively cooperative industry. Absolutely all kinds of people are piling in all the time.
Well, there have been various cases, haven't there, where people whose signature, the violin on Young at Heart with Bobby Valentino, big court case, wasn't it? Because without that signature, it isn't quite the same song. So they're very difficult things to thrash out.
No, but, you know, the way it's gone, you know, in the last 40, 50 years, and you wonder whether it's tenable in the future, is that, you know, the person who gets the benefit is the person who somehow had their credit on it way back in the day, way back in the mists of history. And of course, you know, there's Layla all these years later, you know, what did we say, 50 some years later, still playing a major part in the lives of all kinds of people. And on that note, we'll be...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Back.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So this week in 1965, Bob Dylan released Bringing It All Back Home, which was remarkable in a number of ways. Obviously, it had one side acoustic and one side electric, so it was a bit of a transitional record. But also, one of the things that makes it live so much in the public imagination was the cover. And if you can't remember what the cover looked like, it had Bob Dylan in a kind of upscale bohemian domestic environment in a rather nice house, rather well-dressed. He's got a grey cat on his knee, and he's surrounded by records and magazines and books and so forth. But in the background, looking what I used to be referred to as drop-dead gorgeous, is Sally Grossman, who was the wife of his then manager, Albert Grossman, who's wearing a very striking red outfit and smoking a cigarette like something off an advert you might have found in Life magazine back in the days. And it was a cover that seemed to bristle with signals, didn't it, Mark?
It was extraordinary, Dave. It was a kind of post-folk music positioning statement in that before that he'd been this bloke in a kind of old battered old leather jacket with an acoustic guitar, and he was trying to signify that he was something different. And also, so much mystery, because it wasn't explained. It wasn't like that was an official picture put out. There was no indication as to what was going on or who the person was. I mean, you always imagine, the young teenage me imagined that must be his girlfriend. You know, there were things on there. There was LPs by The Impressions, wasn't there? There was a Robert Johnson album. There was a Ravi Shankar album, which is very extraordinary because this was, I don't know, March 65, and the Beatles didn't start doing, you know, Norwegian Wood didn't come out till December 65.
You know how that stuff, all those elements ended up there? I was looking into this. There's a picture taken by Daniel Kramer, and it was taken at Albert Grossman's house in Woodstock. And the record company, they only said one thing, which is, it's got to have a girl in it.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That was their idea?
Yes. Now, which you can well imagine, actually, because the previous albums, apart from, they probably looked at the previous albums. First album, he's wearing a kind of,
he's we looking like freewheeling Woody. Bob Dylan. Let's do that again.
He was looking like Woody Guthrie.
Yeah.
And freewheeling Bob Dylan famously had Cesar Tolo, and that did really well. And then he had Times the Hour Are Changing, where he looks like a kind of migrant from Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And then another side of Bob Dylan, where he kind of looked like nothing really particularly. And they thought, the one that's done best is the one with the girl. Let's have a girl. And so he didn't want his girlfriend, if he had a girlfriend at the time, to do it. So he just said, Sally Grossman, would you do it? So she did it. And apparently she wore that dress there and never wore it again. She only died a year or so ago, didn't she, Sally Grossman? And
it must have been sold off at auction by
now. I don't think so. And all the elements in the picture were just gathered by Bob Dylan and Daniel Kramer from Albert Grossman's house at the time. You know, so it's got Impressions album, it's got King of the Delta Blues singers, it's got Lotte Lenya.
There's the Francois Zardy album. You can't quite see on the thing, but in the outtakes you can see that it was there.
Yeah, yeah. So they were just kind of gathered in the day. But I do think it was interesting that they thought it ought to have a woman in it. And also the other interesting thing, and I think you touched on it there, it's indoors. Whereas the previous ones didn't, either weren't indoors or didn't look indoors. So suddenly, he's at home. He's got things, you know what I mean? He's wearing nice things. He's got flashy cufflinks and so forth. He looks kind of settled, You know, that was a subliminal message, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But the other thing is that traditionally record covers never had any, I suppose, what you might call context. You know, they were simply the photograph of the star, or they were later on a kind of hypnosis type image, which is an art image meant to kind of add to the value of the whole package. But they weren't contextual. They didn't give you any indication of the lives that these people lived.
No.
And that's an interesting, that's a whole thread, I think, of album covers. There were a particular spate of album covers which basically said, here's my girlfriend, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Paul Simon, you know.
Paul Simon's songbook, which had Kathy from Brentwood, who was his girlfriend at the time, on the cover.
Mandy, was it, on the back of Love Chronicles?
Mandy, with an I, is on the back of Al Stewart's Love Chronicles, you know. And Bert Jansch's, is Bert Jansch in Don't Bother Me?
It's a fantastic sleeve, and he's just looking at the camera in this, I think, sort of bare-board kind of garret type thing. And there in the background is fabulous-looking kind of folk girlfriend, you know. And also, I can remember seeing Tupelo Honey and seeing pictures of Janet Planet.
Yes.
What has happened to Van Morrison? I remember Van Morrison as a kind of barrel house, slightly thuggish looking member of them. And now he's there wearing a kind of blanket and he's walking through woodland with somebody called Janet Planet. You know, it's just absolutely extraordinary.
And Sid
Donald
Marrick,
Giles, do you remember that record?
Donald Giles, because you met.
And I met one of the girls on the sleeve of that record the other day. Who was Giles's wife, a girl called Mary Land, and who was 20 at the time, was still terribly thrilled about it, very proud of it.
Oh, really?
And that was just a really cool thing. Yeah, so it was just such a cool thing, because there was these two guys who just thought, wow, that's the powerful aphrodisiac of music. You know?
That's
dressed like that and being members of King Crimson, and you will find gorgeous women will come flocking, you know.
And then Sid Barrett's, is it the Madcap Laughs?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which has... his then-girlfriend, was she called Iggy?
Iggy the Eskimo, who I think is wearing no clothes at all. She's sitting on a stool in the background, isn't she? Absolutely amazing.
It is, it is. And, of course, so much of this kind of relates to one of the old kind of functions of an LP. If you look in the early days of the LP, and I wrote about this in my book, I'm going to plug my book, A Fabulous Creation. In the development of the LP, was the projection of an LP as being a thing that essentially belonged in a kind of bachelor's lair. You know what I mean? It was, come back and listen to my LP, you know, that kind of idea. And so many of the LPs of the early 60s featured models in negligees or whatever, you know, curling up on a sofa preparatory to listening to the latest album by so-and-so, you know.
Yeah.
So this, the idea you presented the artist in this way, was a little bit of a reflection of that way of doing things, wasn't it? And then you start getting that period in the late 60s and the early 70s where bands start to be photographed in what I think they would probably have described at the time as their pads, surrounded by the detritus of their lives. I think you've got a Soft Machine album.
I found
album
a really
there.
Good version of this, which came out when I was about 15, which is Soft Machine Third. And the big inner gatefold of this has the four members of the group, Elton Dean and Hugh Hopper and Mike Ratledge and Robert Wyatt, just sitting around in a flat. And it's complete. You know, what I loved about it was at the time was that up till then you felt the pictures were very posed. And here we are, we're looking at the camera, we're trying to, this is just a snap. So a snap, one of them is looking at the camera. They're sitting around in this fantastically uncomfortable looking flat with no furniture in it on the floor, surrounded by just detritus, just, you know, empty plates with forks on them, teapots, empty bottles of wine glasses, old biscuits, there's a mandolin, there's some bongos, there's an electric guitar. And, I mean, there was something I found very exciting about that. I don't know why. It was something about the adult world, people living in their own flats. You know,
the basic message was, our mum is not here.
You know, our mum is not here. We haven't done the washing up.
Absolutely. Because that is the great truth. I can remember it so well myself when I first lived in a flat.
Should we do the washout? No, we'll leave it till tomorrow. Who cares?
And then within 3 days, the place was just completely unlivable. I've got one.
Like that scene in Withnail where they look at the undone washing up and say, we'll go in together. We'll go in together in the morning. There's something living in there.
I've been sent one by Stuart Penny, who's been going through his old album covers, looking for examples of this kind of thing. And he sent me a picture of Mann's album, Rhinos, Winos and Lunatics, which
that's
is
fantastic,
a fantastic example of the kind of thing. Because I think one member's reading a copy of Penthouse.
Yeah. it's a bit like the Soft Machine thing. It's kind of bohemian squalor in a way.
Yes,
but the details are so brilliant. In the background of the man picture, there's a bookcase, which we all had at that time, which is made up of bricks and planks.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's just the carpet. Everyone's sitting on the carpet, kind of cross-legged. There's no furniture. There's a Welsh flag. I think there's a Quicksilver Messenger album.
Yes, there is.
But, you know, the copy of Penthouse is a classic example. Again, yeah, we're not with the parents anymore. We got Penthouse.
I think he also sent me Paul Kossoff's Backstreet Crawler.
Oh, another good one.
Album. On the back of that, he's featured in his flat, just off Ladbroke Grove at the time. Basically, flicking V's at the camera, obviously, because that's what you had to do.
Yeah.
But surrounded by posters and hi-fi, you know what I mean? Such as we would have found immensely enviable back in those days. You used to think, look at that picture. Look at the size of his speakers, you know?
Yes.
That was incredibly important to people.
Ashtrays and kit, yes.
Ashtrays. That's the other feature of photographs, genuine photographs from those days, which you no longer see. And if anybody tried to replicate those days, they wouldn't dare include. And that is the great sign that you're in the early 70s is the overflowing ashtray.
It is.
They're genuinely overflowing ashtray. It's a sight. The very thought of it turns my stomach nowadays.
It's the smell of ashtrays. Oh, God. You kind of you eventually fall asleep on a scatter cushion, wake up, you know, with your head virtually in an ashtray with a huge bottle of red wine nearby, half drunk. Oh, God. And a record still on the record player. Go click, click. What? What's happened? What a terror. I'll never do that again.
That's the real 70s, kids.
The Word Podcast. Two cocoa tins and a piece of string.
And we're back with Alex Gold. Say hello, Alex.
Hello, Alex.
And some reader's correspondence. We were talking in recent weeks about bands who might have been held back by inappropriate names. And Peter Nuttall wonders if we're familiar with upcoming indie band Animal Shithouse, because their new EP is entitled House of Shit, and they come from Royal Tunbridge Wells.
Of course they do.
Well, Peter, we were not familiar with them previously, but we are now, as is the whole nation. Yep. Nay, the world.
Unlikely to be hearing him on any radio station near you, but there we are.
There you are.
Shoot yourself in the foot technique.
Yes. So we got some new patron supporters, haven't we, Alex? And we always like to welcome them.
We have indeed. First of all, there's Roger Bentley.
Roger Bentley, which made me recall a rich strand of humour back in the days of the Word office, where you turn people's names into nouns and verbs. Is that right?
Oh, you remember, yes. Bill Withers. Yeah. Tom Waits. Tom Waits permanently standing at a bus stop, wasn't it? And Roy Rogers, in fact, wasn't it? Roy Rogers. I remember David Essex. He always used to do that gag. He'd say, and Roy Rogers, doesn't everyone?
Who else we got, Alex?
We've got Dan Harrison.
Dan Harrison, interesting pop fact. There used to be a guy called Don Harrison, American rock star of the 70s, who, when John Fogerty refused to have anything to do with the other members of Creedence Clearwater Revival, they hired Don Harrison to front the group. You know what I mean? He was the man who'd given the unenviable job of being the new John Fogerty. Not something you wish on your worst enemy, I wouldn't have thought. Anyway, welcome, Dan. Who else, Alex?
Chris Young.
Chris Young, nice. Do we know anything about Chris? Do we know where he comes from or anything like that? We don't, do we? But it's welcome nonetheless. Go on.
Tony Law.
Tony Law, absolutely. Similarly welcome. Please, pull up a scatter cushion and get nearer to the one bar electric fire.
Off which we're lighting roll-up cigarettes.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Drinking Bird's Instant Mellow Coffee. While listening to a Man album.
Yeah. I'd pop in next door to the off-license to get a bottle of Old English cider. Alex, carry on.
Roger D. That's
Roger,
Roger D. Just the capital letter.
Yeah. Dancing with Roger D. Do we think Davey might be Tenacious D's brother?
He might be, or it could be Roger Dean, the sleeve designer, wishing to remain anonymous. And I think the next one also wishes to remain anonymous. Is that right, Alex?
Yeah, this is possibly not their real name. It's Interactive Internet Interloper.
Okay, well.
That's a great bit of alliteration there.
It is. Very welcome, nonetheless.
Absolutely. And finally,
last but not least, Mitch.
Oh, yeah. I like to think that is Eugene Levy, because he plays the part of Mitch, doesn't he? In that fine Christopher Guest film, A Mighty Wind.
That's a particularly moving thing, isn't it? There's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, the song that they sing. Do you remember when all the bands appear in the wings to see where they kiss at the end of
it? Whether they kiss it. Because Mitch is one member of a duo called Mitch and Mickey. With Kathleen O'Hara, I think, is Mickey. And they're supposed to be some kind of Peter, Paul and Mary or Sonny and Cher type couple. And if you haven't seen A Mighty Wind, go and, you know, correct that terrible error as soon as possible. Because the great thing about Christopher Guest films, as compared to pretty much any humorous films, I'm prepared to go on record as saying this. You can watch them again and again and
there's
again.
There's so many little details.
You never get tired of them. Unlike a lot of comedy films where you think, no, I'm laughed out at that, really. You know, the Christopher Guest films, you know, Wednesday with Guffman and things like that. And Best in Show, Spinal Tap, obviously. A Mighty Wind, you can go back to them again and again.
Because most comedy shows are just about telling gags, aren't they? But it's really about the relationships between the people. That's what's so touching.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
All the Mighty Wind crew and their relationships, the Guffman actors, and Spinal Tap, and their sort of wounded looks at each other when they feel let down.
It's very deep. Well, they always say that tragedy is comedy played at a different speed, isn't it? You know, it's the same thing. Anyway, welcome all those people to our Patreon army. And so they'll now be able to take advantage of such things as the Friday night quiz, which is the ideal way to start your weekend. And if you haven't joined us in the past, do make a point to do it. That happens at 6 o'clock every Friday, where we get together via Zoom and we present people with 10 visual clues to the identity of a famous or maybe not so famous album. And according to how quickly they manage to decipher that, they may be in for... Well, a major prize, isn't that like?
A
isn't
major
that right?
prize, and it's brilliant because people gather from all over the world.
They do.
At this particular time, at 6 o'clock UK time on Friday nights. It's very good.
And, you know, if you win, you can be the proud owner of such trinkets as, Alex, what did we give most recently? I think we had a fridge magnet, didn't we?
We did. We had a genuine Hawaiian fridge magnet.
So there you go, you know. More
incentive could you possibly need?
All this could be yours. And I think that's it from us this week. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.